This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Most of writer Ron Rash's work begins as a single image, pictures that live in his head. His first novel, One Foot in Eden, started as a snapshot of a farmer standing in a field with his crops dying all around him. His second novel, Saints at the River, grew from a vision of a child looking up through the water. Whatever the spark, all his works carry his Western North Carolina ancestry, and they're populated by Appalachian characters and reverberant with mountain dialect. The settings are specific to the region, but the themes are universal. They deal with marriage and death, the environment, and much, much more. It's in the last decade or so Ron Rash has really gained recognition for his writing. He's won many accolades, including the Appalachian Book of the Year Award for One Foot in Eden, the 2005 Southern Book Critics Circle Award for Saints at the River, and he was a Penn Faulkner Award finalist for his last novel, Serena. As part of our occasional series, North Carolina Literary Lights, we're going to focus today on the work of poet and author Ron Rash. He's a professor of Appalachian Cultural Studies at Western Carolina University and joins us now by phone. Ron Rash, welcome.
I'm glad to be with you today.
You're a writer whose work is defined by, in many ways, by your family heritage going back centuries. Tell us about your family's history and how it influences your work.
My family, both my mother's family and my father's, both families have been in the Appalachian, Western North Carolina mountains since the late 1700s. So certainly an awareness of that, the stories that have been passed on, the sense of place, I think has been something very important to me as a writer.
How much of those stories that you heard growing up have made their way into your work, would you say?
Several. They weave their way into the novels, but in my last collection of short stories, two of the stories were actually based on incidents that had occurred in my family.
How many of them, too, are kind of folk tales? Do they get carried on in your family as well as actual family stories? And, you know, do they find their way into your work as well?
They do. And I feel like I was very lucky that as a child I spent a lot of time with my older relatives, particularly with my grandmother on her farm near Boone. And I got to hear this very, very often very poetic language, very rich in metaphor, and the stories that came along with that, and very often the folkways.
We mentioned a couple of your novels at the top of this interview. Your last novel, Serena. Tell us a little bit about this. Give us a summary.
It's a novel that is about the Depression era and 1928-29, and it's ultimately about the fight between the logging industry and the people trying to build or create the Smoky Mountains National Park. I also feel that it was a book about what was happening in the United States, not in 1928 or 29, but in the early part of our century.
What happening in general? You mean an environmental struggle?
Environmental struggles, the very real fear that a lot of the national parks that were hard won might be destroyed.
Will you read for us from Serena?
Sure. This is a scene early in the book, and a young woman named Rachel Harmon, whose father's just died, a very hard man, but she's trying to remember a moment about him that she can hold on to. Think of something happy, she told herself. Something he did for you, a small thing. For a few moments, nothing came. Then something did, something that had happened about this time of year. After supper, father had gone to the barn while she went to the garden. In the waning light, she'd gathered ripe pole beans whose dark pods nestled up to the rows of sweet corn she'd planted as trellis. Her father called from the barn mouth, and she'd set the washpan between two rows, thinking he needed her to carry the milk pail to the spring house. Pretty, isn't it? He'd said as she entered the barn. Her father pointed to a large silver-green moth. For a few minutes, the chores were put off as the two of them just stood there. The barn's stripes of light grew dimmer, and the moth seemed to brighten as if the slow open and close of its wings gathered up the evening's last light. Then the creature rose. As the moth fluttered out into the night, her father had lifted his large, strong hand and settled it on Rachel's shoulder a moment, not turning to her as he did so. A moth at twilight, the touch of a hand. Something, Rachel thought.
Ron Rash, our North Carolina literary light today on the state of things, reading from his last novel, Serena. Place certainly plays a very important part. It becomes a character in your books. When we think about the environmental struggle, is this a kind of mindset, those who think about place as something living, something vibrant that could be written in as a character, and those who see it as commodity? Is that a fair way to look at the struggle, the environmental struggle that you talked about earlier?
I think it's always very complex, but I think certainly in a way that is it. I mean, the view of loving a place and a view of, as you say, seeing it merely as a commodity, I think those are the two ways that seem to be prevalent today.
When you
maybe always, yeah.
When you take on an issue like that, we talked about, and maybe I'll get you to talk more about the genesis of your writing, particularly your fiction, starting out as an image. Is that true? Can you describe that for us?
It is. It's absolutely the way it happens. I never outline. I never have a plot in mind or a theme or an idea. I start with the image and have faith that it'll lead me somewhere.
Then you move on, but you also talk about these important themes that come out in your book that you write about and certainly think about. Are they after the fact, or does the theme and the image, or do they come in pretty close sequence?
I think they come in a way maybe after the fact, and they, I hope they feel organic, and I see my work more as being a witness than a propagandist. I hope I reveal. These things reveal themselves, but I leave it up to the reader to make the decisions of what may be right or wrong. I think that's part of what a novelist does, is to have a certain degree of faith in the reader.
You came to writing relatively later in your life than some. What started you? What sparked your interest?
I'd always been a voracious reader as a child. I didn't write until I was in college, but I think, like a lot of people who become writers, that you see somebody do this, you feel it's important, and you ultimately ask yourself, "Well, could I do this?" And I tried and kept trying when I wasn't doing it very well.
Well, when you say, "Could I do this?" Why would you want to?
I think just. That as a child, I'd always been a child who was rather imaginative. I liked making up stories in my head, even if I didn't write them down. And I think there's something wonderful about the communion that I felt as a reader with a writer, and I wanted to, kind of do that from the other side.
And you talked about the stories that animate your works and your imagination, stories you heard growing up. I guess much of that was in the oral tradition, right? I mean, these are stories that were passed down orally.
Certainly, but I think in a way I was very fortunate in that while I was part of that oral tradition and heard those stories growing up, my family, my parents particularly encouraged all of us in the family, all the children to read. So I got both. I got reading novels and stories, Jack London, Mark Twain early on, but also getting these stories from my older family members. And that was just a wonderful mixture.
Do you try to recreate the feeling that you get from hearing a story in your literature, or is it just a fundamentally different thing?
I hope that I do try. I want the reader to feel, first off, more than anything, that to get involved in the story, to want to read on, to be entertained. And so you start there, and then you hope the reader starts to find other layers of the work.
before you were a novelist, you were a poet. You're still doing that, but I think you began writing poetry. What do you think? Is there something that you can do with poetry that you can't do in your novels or your short stories?
Oh, definitely, and the ultimate concision of it. I mean, what I love about poetry and the poets that have meant the most to me is the ability to say so much in just a few lines, and to say it so memorably that that once it's read or heard, the reader cannot forget it.
Do you have work that began as one and ended as another?
Oh yeah, and that's once again. I very often I don't know when I start with an image if it will become a poem or a short story or a novel, and sometimes I try all three.
Yeah, give us some examples.
Well, with One Foot in Eden, I actually started off with about a 14-line poem about a farmer standing in a field, and that didn't seem to say whatever I wanted to be said. And after that, I tried a short story. And when I realized that whatever that image demanded of me had not been satisfied, I ultimately wrote a novel.
You know, it's interesting you talked about that, the concision in poetry, the fact that in a few words, the image can be, the idea can be so sharp that it lasts with the reader for a long, long time. And you think, well, if that's it, then we should all be aspiring to poetry. That should be the highest form. But as you suggest, there are other forms. Are there ideas that just can't be expressed in poetry and some that only can be expressed? Is it the question, is it a matter of the idea itself, the image? In other words, are there some things that can only be expressed in one form or another?
I think with the short story and more, even more so the novel, what I find that can be done so much better there is to allow the reader to enter a world, to live in a world for, you know, sometimes 300-400 pages, and I think that sense of the reader being able to really immerse himself or herself into that world is, I think novels probably or do that better.
We've talked about your poetry. Can I ask you to read one for us?
Yes. This is a poem about an old veterinarian in the North Carolina mountains going out on a call. Call that none of the younger vets will take. It's called 3 a.m. and the stars were out. When the phone rings way too late for good news, just another farmer wanting me to lose half a night's sleep, drive some backcountry washout for miles, fix what he's botched. On such nights, I'm like an old drowsy god tired of answering prayers. So let it ring a while, hope they might hang up. Though of course they don't. Don't because they know the younger vet shook off these dark expeditions to me, thinking it's my job, not theirs. Because I've done it so long, I'm used to such nights. Because old as I am, I'll still do what they refuse to. And soon I'm driving out of Marshall, headed north, most often toward Shelton Laurel, toward some barn where a calf that's been bad bred to save stud fees is trying to be born, or a cow laid out in a barn stall, dying of milk fever, easily cured if a man hadn't wagered against his own dismal luck, waited too late, hoping to save my fee for a salt lick, roll of barbed wire. And it's not all his fault. Poor too long turns the smartest man stupid. Makes him see nothing beyond a short-term gain. Which is why I know more likely than not, I'll be arriving too late. What's to be done best done with rifle or shotgun? So make driving the good part. Turn off my radio. Let the dark close around until I know a kind of loneliness that doesn't feel sad as I pass the homes of folks I don't know, may never know, but wonder what they are dreaming, what life they wake to. Thinking such things, or sometimes just watching for what stays unseen except on country roads after midnight, the copperhead soaking up what heat the blacktop still holds, foxes and bobcats. One time in the 50s, a panther, yellow eyes bright as truck beams, black-tipped tail swishing before leaping away through the trees, back into its extinction. All this thinking and watching, keeping my mind off what waits on up the road. Worst of all, the calves I have to pull one piece at a time, birthing death. Though sometimes it all works out. I turn a calf's head, and then, like a safe combination, the womb unlocks, calf slides free. Or this night when stubborn life got back on its feet, round eyes clear and hungry, my IV stuck in its neck, and I take my time packing up, ask for a second cup of coffee, so I can linger a while in the barn mouth watching stars awake in their wide pasture.
Ron Rash reading the poem 3 a.m. and the Stars Were Out, our literary light today on the state of things. Well, now, there is a story that I was deeply immersed in, and it didn't take 300 pages.
Right. True.
But a story, an old, drowsy god tired of answering prayers. Wow. Did you know this veterinarian?
No, but I knew men like him and women. I've always had great admiration for veterinarians. In my experience, they've all been extraordinary people, but I was particularly struck by that growing up because one of my uncles actually had cattle and livestock, and I remember several times the vet coming out there and, you know, and coming out there very often, as I say in the poem or imply, that, you know, they may not get paid, they may not save the animal, but they go anyway.
Well, one of the great things, I think the thing that that poem illustrates is this question that all of us have, you know, what is it about Appalachian fiction, mountain fiction, or a Southern writing? You know, it seems to be a genre, it's a type, and yet we never, ever grow tired of it. And maybe this was an insight into that, that seeing the story told, for the same characters show up, but from every different perspective. Here is the veterinarian, late at night, driving past, telling, you know, the stories of each of those people. All those different perspectives keeps it ever from becoming the same old, same old.
Well, I hope so, and I think the Southern writing that matters the most and will endure will be that which, while it's deeply ingrained in the region, ultimately is universal at the same time. Eudora Welty has a wonderful quote about one place understood helps us understand all other places better, and to me that's what Southern fiction does best.
Do you see certain themes reemerging in your work?
I do. Very often I think other people see them than I, because I tend not to be that conscious of them. But certainly I think themes of mortality, religion, belief, faith, very often the tragic sense of life, people are reminding me that those are seem to reoccur in my work. But you know, ultimately, not so much themes. My hope would be, as a writer, that what I'm doing is at least giving a little bit of insight into what it means to be alive, to be a human being.
It seems to be doing that and more. Ron Rash, thank you so much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed it.
Ron Rash is an author and poet. His novels include Serena, Saints at the River, and One Foot in Eden, also a professor of Appalachian Cultural Studies at Western Carolina University. Just ahead, the music of Brenda Linton and the Kinglets. Stay with us on The State of Things.